Today on Movie Wallahs, we review Joy and The Hateful Eight. It's time for Movie Wallahs. Hi, this is Joe.
Hi, it's Rashmi.
And ESD as well.
Movie Wallahs is your weekly dose of film reviews, movie news and general banter in theatres, on DVD, online streaming or in the back of an airplane. If you love the movies, the show is for you. Greetings all.
Good evening.
Hello.
Title of our podcast, Joy and the Hateful Eight. It's quite the opposite.
Correct.
It's like Inside Out.
Yes.
We're going to have a lot to talk about, I think, with these movies. So we should start quickly with our Netflix picks for this week. So this segment, I can't find anything to watch on Netflix, is really just our way of telling you what deliciousness we have found in our lists and give you a little tidbit. Maybe you're struggling to pick a movie tonight, so here's a couple of selections for us. So Rashmi, or Yazdi, what have you got this week?
So my recommendation this week, in light with it being holiday season, is a perfectly delightful little movie. It's German, continuing in my line of foreign film recommendations, and it's called Mostly Marta. And this movie came out like 4 or 5 years ago, maybe even longer. And I think it might be known to most people here by virtue of the Hollywood remake, which was god-awful and had Catherine Zeta-Jones in it, called No Reservations. But forget that crappy remake. Go and watch the original. It's got bite, and it's just fill your heart with the joyful holiday spirit. It's about a very uptight chef, a self-made woman who's kind of fought hard to rise to the top of her game. And she runs a mean ship at a very upscale, very modern restaurant in Germany. And she, through no choice of hers, suddenly has to take care of her recently orphaned niece. And the niece is a teenager and she's 13 and she knows everything. And the two women just don't get along and they have to learn to live together and blah, 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 and all that stuff. And there's a romantic interest and it's just done avoiding every single Hollywood trope. And it's beautiful and it's about food and it's about, you know, hard people who need to learn to soften. I don't know. It's good stuff. Mostly Martha.
Mostly Martha. Okay.
Freshly. Okay, so mine, in keeping with the bite of today's show, is a movie called Filth that came out last year, and it stars James McAvoy and Jamie Bell, and it's kind of a Scottish movie, and it's actually directed and written by this guy called John S. Baird, and it's based on a novel, and basically it's about this corrupt junkie cop who has a borderline personality disorder, and he's going for a promotion. And he has to win the promotion in order to win back his wife and his daughter. But he manages to like manipulate his way through everything, and he thinks he can win. But it's James McAvoy as you've never seen him before, and this is a hard R. I'll just let you all know. It's called Filth. Brilliant movie. Very dark. Very funny.
Oh, good.
Really good.
My pick's a documentary. It's called Sushi, A Global Catch. Not a great film in the sense of when you compare it to the likes of Jiro, Dreams of Sushi, but it's still a worthwhile watch in the sense of if you have interest in food, in sushi in particular, it's a really it's a really insightful little documentary on how sushi and the global demand for sushi has affected the world markets. It does get a little preachy towards the end, so I'll warn you there if you're not necessarily into the world is dying environmental type messaging. The movie does get very heavy-handed on that towards the end, but nonetheless, it's an interesting eye-opening documentary about really the popularity of sushi. And there's some wonderful food porn at the beginning.
I mean,
It's just a visual treat.
All our recommendations today are about food.
Well, 2 out of 3.
Well, yours is not?
No.
Filth. Oh, dear. Okay.
Yes.
So we have Mostly Martha, Filth, and Sushi, A Global Catch. Check them out. So I'm guessing that we're going to have a lot to say about both movies this week. We have Joy and we have The Hateful Eight. So where would you guys like to start?
Hateful Eight.
Ooh, I thought you were going to say Joy.
No, Tarantino always trumps David O. Russell. No? I don't know.
Well, we will see.
We will see.
So this movie needs no introduction, really. It's Tarantino's eighth movie.
Mm-hmm.
He playfully says that in the credits of most of his films. This is a script that's been a long time in coming. He wrote it a couple of years ago, and then to much fanfare, he sent it to five people, one of whom leaked it. And it got published online, and he had a bit of a tantrum. Said that he was never going to make the film because it got leaked. And then through Film Independent ended up doing a table read, which Rashmi and I were fortunate enough to get tickets to. And during that, the audience response was so phenomenal that I think he was energized and said officially then that he was going to make a play to make the movie. So it's essentially set in the Old West. A huge star cast this movie has. Channing Tatum, Samuel L. Jackson, Kurt Russell, Jennifer Jason Leigh, Walton Goggins, Damon Bashir, Tim Roth, Michael Madsen, Bruce Dern. Big, huge ensemble Tarantino cast. And I don't really want to say too much about the plot other than it begins with a stagecoach that is passing through the Old West.
In the dead of winter.
In the dead of winter, that's as much as I think that we need to say introduction-wise. So who wants to give us their opinion of The Hateful Eight?
Well, I'm dying to hear what you guys thought. So, Yasti, why don't you go first?
Oh, what do I say about this one? I mean, I have such a love-hate relationship with Tarantino. I think he's one of our most gifted directors. I will watch Kill Bill until the day I die and Inglourious Basterds. But he just has a problem with... He's a one-trick pony. He's becoming a one-trick pony. I mean, there's so much to admire about this movie. So I'm just going to come out and say, who is making a three-hour movie right now? Who is releasing it in 70 millimeters before the actual digital release? Who is making a movie with an intermission? Who is making a character study of eight characters who are just talking for the first hour and a half? So there's so... And, you know, I love that he sticks his finger up to all commercial interests and says, this is how I'm going to make a movie. Deal with it. I'm Tarantino. If you want to see my movie, come see it. And I fall at his feet with reverence that there needs to be somebody like that who's just standing up to all commercial interests and doing what he wants. Unfortunately for me, it was all completely fatally undone by the last part of the movie. I cannot forgive it for that. Sorry. It's not a good movie because of that.
So, you know, this isn't going to be for everyone. And if you don't like Tarantino or you have a problem with gross violence or the N-word, then don't watch the movie, okay? Just don't go and watch it. But if you're like me, you're a diehard Quentin fan, then this will delight. And boy, I was delighted. This is over the top. It's self-indulgent. It leaves you with no doubt that this is Quentin Tarantino's voice. But that's what I love. This isn't your standard movie. It's amazing. It blew me away.
Joe, be the voice of reason.
I'm in the middle. So I'm going to be the voice of reason today. It's not the best Tarantino film.
No.
But it's more of the good stuff that he always brings to the cinema. And I'll have to say that I come to it with a bias. I'm a huge fan of his. I don't think I've disliked any movie that he has made. And this really is more of the same. You have the same mix of characters that you see oftentimes in Tarantino movies. You have the same actors that you see playing the same characters that you see in Tarantino movies. I enjoyed every minute of this movie's 187 minutes running time, but I agree with you, Yazdi. The post-intermission section just goes to crazy town. And while we always expect something of a debacle at the end of a Tarantino movie, it was not as satisfyingly wrapped up as his other movies. So, you know, Rashmi and I saw The Table Read and it had a different ending.
So you saw the whole thing?
Yeah, they read the full script from start to finish. But in the final act, it ended basically with a Mexican standoff and everyone was obliterated. You know, this movie ended up, they did something different in that kind of post-intermission section. And as playful as it was so out there. It was just like crazy town that it made me smile, but it was not satisfying.
So my thing is, you know, I wish he had released this as The Hateful Eight Part 1 and The Hateful Eight Part 2, because The Hateful Eight Part 1 would have been on my list of the best movies of the year.
It was amazing.
And where would you have cut it then?
They missed
at the intermission.
At the intermission.
Okay,
I think something very dreadful happens right before the intermission, and it ends there. And it's a perfect way to end it. And up until that point, I was just 100% in love with the movie. It's, you know, music is as much what you hear as what you see and what you can smell, and you have such a great sense of place. And that music, my God, the music is amazing in this movie.
Yeah.
And it takes, you know, he takes his time with the shots. He takes his time introducing these characters. Everybody has a backstory that, you know, he's setting up so wonderfully all of those eight characters up. And I just filled me up. And then I think deliberately after the intermission, there's a complete change in there's a change in tone. There wasn't a voiceover and I'm not giving anything away. After the intermission, suddenly there's a voiceover. Somebody is actually relating what's going on, which was also fine. But then I have the same problem that I had with this movie that I had with Django Unchained, is that the last half hour becomes some Cinemax movie from the 80s. You know, it becomes kind of this comical horror movie, and I mean I've invested so much time, I love these characters, I care for them, and it's just like Tarantino said, oh, that's the only way I know to get rid of, you know, to bring any conclusion to these characters is do horrible things to them. And just I wanted more. I had so much invested in these characters.
So I saw it a different way, Yasti. So for me, and again I'm biased, Tarantino's genius is his ability to play with time and the sequence of the movie. Mm-hmm. And no one does it like him. And I agree with you. Sometimes this movie plays more like a horror than a Western. But I think the music had a lot to do with that. But I think what it does is it takes movie making and it throws it on its head, because we don't actually know whose story it is. Whose arc is this story? We don't know.
All eight
it could
of
be
them.
Nobody's. It turns
well,
out
that's the joy of it in a way, right? So I think that if you go in with an expectation that you're going to see a three-act movie with a traditional arc, we don't necessarily get that. What we do get, and you said it right at the beginning, it's a character story. It's a really interesting character story of what we see on the screen, which is completely different to what really is happening. And that, for me, was the genius in the second half. Because everything that was set up in the first half is totally turned on its head in the second half.
But I was with it till the last 20 minutes of it, when it just became disrespectful to those characters, I think.
Yeah.
You know, because it's almost like you're going to see a cartoon movie and suddenly you see porn. It was that jolting to me.
Oh, okay.
Like, you know, like I'm watching it. It's a cartoon movie, these cartoon characters, and whoa, what's going on? There's porn on screen. It was that jolting to me.
Wow.
It was just like, what happened?
So, I'm with Yasti a little bit in terms of this last bit of the movie, because one of the things that Tarantino does brilliantly is he is able to introduce tension into a scene through revelations that are made in dialogue, but status changes and stakes just keep building and building and building and building. And it's almost like, you know, he's setting up this domino thing, right? Everything's being set up and you can see all this wonderful stuff that's going to happen.
And it comes from left field.
It does. And it's beautiful.
Yeah.
It ends up being a little bit of an anticlimax when the trick isn't pulled off at the end to give you this amazing show that you're expecting to get. And I think, you know, he made the decision to deliberately overcook the finale. Like it.
Agreed.
It boils over and it's so like, It's almost lazy in the sense of there's no way to resolve the conflicts that have been set up other than to, like, just, you know, go to this horror movie place that the movie kind of ends up in. So
do you feel like it's almost like it got so crazy that it's like, oh, it was all a dream? It's not as crazy as that, right? I just want to be realistic in
stakes,
our review.
It
does get crazy, but it's not like, oh,
no,
and then they woke up and it was all a dream. It's not like that.
No, it's not like, and it's so beautifully structured. Nobody does it. Like you said, nobody does it like Tarantino does. you know, there's this whole like, and then this, you know, things play out up until a certain point, and then there's this whole other piece like earlier that day,
right?
And then there's, and nobody does it as well as him. So you, it's like somebody's building this beautiful jigsaw puzzle, and all these pieces are fitting into each other. And then somebody comes and pees on it. It's like, don't do this. You know, we cared about these character actors so much. So it's like he's incapable of, he's such a brilliant writer. He's one of the best writers. And then somehow he's incapable of finding a good enough resolution. And he kind of falls back on, you know, this gore, which is, I didn't belong here. I don't know.
I liked it. I mean, for me, it wouldn't be a Tarantino movie if you didn't get that. Right, half the fun of watching, and I hate saying half the fun because I'm not into violent movies generally, but how would you feel if you went to something like a Tarantino movie and you got The Danish Girl?
I would love it. I want Tarantino. This is what I'm going to say. I want Tarantino to do a comedy.
But it is comedy.
No.
This is one of the funniest films of the year.
I mean, it's amazing. You want him to do straight comedy.
Straight, like a romantic comedy. I want him to do James Bond.
No, he wouldn't know how to do that. And I think he's placed himself squarely in this unique genre that he owns. Like, no one else is in this space, not in the way that he is.
I know, but I'm at a place now where I don't want to watch another movie like this. I just don't.
Mm.
It's like, even Scorsese doesn't make mobster movies anymore. He's moved on. That used to be his thing, you know? So I don't know. It's like, why keep doing the same thing? It's like,
because it's fun.
And it's him. I mean, the thing. Two more things I wanted to say. One is, he really has this ability to get the best acting out of his people that he uses. And I know he has muses, Tim Roth, you know,
Sam Jackson, that sure don't sound
Michael
like
Madsen. You know, I mean, there are the same people that he uses, but boy, he can get these amazing performances out of them. And I have to say, Jennifer Jason Leigh, phenomenal. What a phenomenal performance. And that's difficult to do, I think. I mean, granted, Yasti, it's a movie which is very misogynistic and sexist, but I don't know. There's just something about it that's just incredible to me. I mean, the 5-minute overture at the beginning of the movie, you know, I think people are going to think it's precious and it's really self-indulgent, like I said at the beginning. But what I think it does, because it's a good 5 minutes, that overture. It's literally a red screen with a stagecoach and it says overture on it. And it's 5 minutes of music. And I think what it did for me was it made me forget everything else that I was doing or thinking about. And it put me in that world immediately.
No, I love all that. I love the structure of the movie. I love how it takes its time. I love the intermission. You know, it's just, there's a pathology to him. I kind of worry about Tarantino now because his female characters are either, you know,
superheroes.
Right. Yeah. Who have been wronged and who are out to get justice, or they are hateful things to whom men do hateful things.
But so are his male characters.
Yeah,
but
true.
I mean, so there's a weird pathology, right? So all of his movies, for some reason, have this thing about the N-word, okay? It doesn't matter if it's set now or it's set at frontier time, as this movie is. It's getting comical now. You cannot have somebody's in this movie. I lost. There must be what 15,000 times the word is.
I started counting and I lost count. And I got bored of counting.
It kind of worries me. Why is he so obsessed with the N word? I mean, so there's one thing.
Buttons.
But you can push buttons after the fifth time, but after the 500th time, it just kind of seems sickening. It's like, why
push your buttons?
And then it did.
I agree. It's and excessive. Then
he,
yeah.
You know, from. Pulp Fiction times, he has this kind of weird thing about gay panic. You know, for him, the worst thing that can happen to a man is, you know, for him to be involved in a sexual act with another man. This keeps playing out in his movies again and again and again. So he kind of keeps going back to the same thing. And then there's that just, and my thing is, I love good violence, right? I mean, if it's done well, but then you can't have somebody spitting like a bucket of blood out of their mouth. It pulls you out of the movie. There's literally somebody who throws up a bucket of red blood. It's like somebody pulled you by your hair and put you outside, you know, by the popcorn stand, right out of your movie seat. So it's like he can't resist.
But that's the comedy of it, right? Because you're right, that would never happen.
No, I think I'm with Yasti again on this, because it was finely crafted theater.
It's so beautiful theater.
You know, put the language and all of that stuff aside. Up until it goes nuts. This is
beautiful.
Finely crafted theater. And the whole movie reminded me of one of my favorite scenes in Inglourious Bastards, the farmhouse.
Yes.
Where the stakes just keep escalating and it's frightening and it's tense. It's so tense. I mean, it's edge of your seat tension. So I think it's the tension release in this one that ends up really, you know, that's kind of where we're disappointed in terms of the resolution. But
I loved Walter Goggins. Walter Goggins was so good in this movie. Everyone was so good. But this is the last thing I say, because I could go on. I love that no one, however big the name is, I love that no one's safe. You know, that's the joy of a Tarantino movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's why the tension's so good, because you don't know who's going to... I mean, just because you're Leonardo DiCaprio, it doesn't matter. If you're in a Tarantino movie...
Well, now it seems, yeah, you're guaranteed something bad's going to happen to you.
Right.
I also like that, I mean, I'll completely give it to you. I mean, he's genius when it comes to casting. I mean, like Alexander Payne, he completely discounts commercial interests. Like, is there a single actor within the Hateful Eight who are big name stars? Not a one of them are. And, you know, he loves these old weathered faces, you know, and he likes, you know, people to have character, and they're so beautifully written and so beautifully constructed. And I love that. I could imagine he got a lot of pressure saying, hey, you should hire, I don't know, Brad Pitt or somebody. But he said, no, every one of my Hateful Eight, they are perfect for their role. And I'm not going to pick somebody more commercial. So good for him.
Final thing. And Joe and I did see this as a stage play. This would work beautifully as a stage play. It's basically two scenes.
The whole movie,
two locations.
Two locations.
I think that's genius as well. We hardly ever see, the stagecoach, and then we're Minis.
Yeah.
But let's wind this one up. So, Yasti, why don't you go first?
Listen, there's a reason why, you know, Tarantino doesn't have a Best Director Oscar yet, and he won't get it unless he kind of breaks this thing and kind of does something different. You know, what's his name? Oh, gosh, why am I blanking out? Ang Lee has two Oscars because no two movies of his are alike. And I want him to do something different. This is so beautifully constructed, so beautifully written, and then just completely undone by what seems to me like his inability to be anything other than a one-trick pony. And, you know, for me, the last end of this movie was exactly almost identical to the ending of Django Unchained. And, you know, you should not make two consecutive movies set in around the same time, around the same issues, which end the same way. So, you know, there are lots of issues. So I love that Tarantino exists. I bow at his feet, but I want him to do something different. 6 out of 10.
Joe, I nearly fell off my chair.
Rashmi used the word earlier, indulgent, and that's exactly how I felt about it. I mean, it was indulgent, it was longer than it needed to be, but I thought it was absolutely bloody marvellous. I mean, there was not a moment in this movie where I didn't feel thoroughly, thoroughly entertained. As I stepped away from the movie theatre, I think, you know, the whole, we've spoken about it, the whole post-intermission section of the movie is weaker than what had come before it, and disappointingly so. So that knocks a point off what would otherwise be an easy 9 out of 10. It's going to be a not so hateful 8. This is, it's going to be one of my favorite films of the year. And you know, Yasti, you say there's a reason he doesn't have a Best Director Oscar. Well, I think he needs the recognition here for this one. I mean, not necessarily the top prize, but I think a nomination wouldn't be amiss for me, because there's no one else that does it this way.
if he had released the first part separately, I would be the first one saying, give it to him already. Just give it to him. But
so the one thing we didn't mention was, like The Revenant, this has amazing cinematography. I mean, when do we ever say that, you know, yes, Tarantino does cinematography? This has got incredible cinematography that we didn't even get to talk about. I love the way he throws in like Yoda, like nugget knowledges, like Yoda knowledge. There's this 5-minute sequence that's all about the importance of justice, right? It was beautiful to watch. Love, 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 love. So biased. Love, 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 love. 9 out of 10. And I agree with you. I think that overuse of the N-word, the very end, knocked a point off. This would have been a 10 out of 10 for me otherwise.
I'll tell you what the breaking point for me was. For me, the breaking point was when what happens to the Jennifer Jason Leigh character. I'm like, come on. I mean, I believe this character. I mean, she's at the center of the whole movie. And I know he's never been one to be moral and say good things happen to the good people, bad things happen to the bad people. But it just seemed like a weird merry-go-round of like, you know, what's going to happen to you? You know, what's going to happen to you?
But that was part of the fun.
It is the fun. But then I was like, yeah.
All right.
Anyway.
We've spoken a lot about The Hateful Eight. We have another movie to cover in this podcast, and that is Joy.
Okay, so Joy is the story of a family across 4 generations and the woman who rises to become founder and matriarch of a powerful family business dynasty. So this is directed by David O. Russell. It's written by David O. Russell and Annie Mumolo, who was actually one of the writers of Bridesmaids with Kristen Wiig. And it stars, again, his muse, Jennifer Lawrence, Bradley Cooper, and another appearance by Robert De Niro. Virginia Madsen is in this, and a whole host of others. So we are getting the holiday end of year spectacular from David O. Russell that we've seen at least for the last 2 years. Joe, why don't you kick this one off?
So I'm a bit annoyed with Russell's very deliberate play into the awards seasons. I think it's really frustrating to me that he always kind of does this, you know, surgically targeted strike.
4 years in a row, 4 movies.
Yeah.
Oh, it boom, is four. Boom, I thought boom. It was just...
Yeah, the King's... Not the King's...
American Silver Hustle, Silver Linings
Playbook, American Hustle, The Fighter, and Joy.
Yeah, boom, boom, boom. So yeah. This is not my favorite David O. Russell movie. I liked it more than last year's American Hustle, which I thought was too much of a lark. The only real standout feature of this movie is an incredible performance by Jennifer Lawrence. She's a striking actress, and her versatility never fails to astound me. She does such a wonderful job here that I'll be surprised if she's not recognized. But overall, you know, this movie was, I had a good time here. It has its weaknesses, and we'll talk about those, but you know, this wasn't a bad film.
Yes, Dee.
It is a bad film.
Nonsense.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I don't know. David O. Russell is hit or miss for me when it works. I really like Silver Linings Playbook. I love Three Kings. I love I Heart Huckabees. But there's something very deliberate and something very look ma, no hands kind of thing. The very fact that this movie was ready, you know, 6 months ago, but they're releasing it on Christmas Day. He's definitely playing into this, you know, and then everybody who is in his movie always gets nominated for Oscars. So I don't like where he's gotten to in terms of all this posturing. But put all of that aside, it doesn't matter if this movie was released in the middle of the year as well. I think it's a very watchable movie, but frankly, I have no clue what attracted him to this story. I mean, this story absolutely did not interest me. There is literally 2,000 other stories like this. After, you know, American Hustle and Silver Linings Playbook, this to me seems like a story which was like not even worthy of Lifetime. It just like, why did this story need to be told? And God knows, he's a good writer. He tries his best. He tries to color it up. The first half hour of the movie is brilliant with all these characters around her life. And then he really doesn't know how to end the movie. He does not know how to end the movie. So it's just really subpar. I don't think you should waste your Christmas dollar watching this. You know, watch it on Netflix.
Please. Wow.
Yeah, sorry.
I'm with Yasti. I think it's an adequate holiday movie that has David O. Russell's fingerprint all over it. I mean, it's funny and humorous, but I think it's super polished, but it's tonally inconsistent. Mm-hmm. And I didn't love it at all. I was impressed with it. But it seemed, Joe, you mentioned that American Hustle was a caper. This was more of a caper for me. And I felt like it had quirkiness and game for the sake of having that. And there was no story to hang on to. What I will say is, though, Jennifer Lawrence can act. And yeah. I agree with you that she should be recognized for her acting. She's a great, great actress. I just felt like there wasn't depth.
Well, yeah. The thing that I think you're sensing here is how contrived the whole setup felt. In some ways, this was, you know, there were no surprises in terms of how this plot played out. I think what I enjoyed most about it was just the mechanics of how it all clicked together, because I think, you know, watching this kind of dysfunctional family situation, watching some of the business scenarios play out the way that they did, you know, we have a family member who's, you know, entrepreneurial right now, and it really struck a chord with me, thinking she needs to watch out for some of the characters that she's going to interact with. And to me, I guess it was not a remarkable story in terms of one that has to be told, right? This isn't, you know, overcoming apartheid or anything like that, you know. But it was still an interesting character study of, and I don't know how factual this any of this stuff is, but it was still a really interesting character study of somebody who has a, you know, a very dysfunctional environment and yet still somehow prevails. And at least the movie's portrayal of who she is at the end of it all still retains some of that humility and, you know, a remembrance of that adversity. So I just connected with it on that particular level. And I think a lot of it was, I was completely mesmerized by Lawrence in this.
Really?
I couldn't take my eyes off her for a second.
I'm the same with you, Joe, with respect to Lawrence's performance, which is what I said. I think the issue here is that, unlike his other movies where there are many rounded characters, in this movie, the only one that's fully rounded and fully realized seems to be the Lawrence character. Everyone else is just a
plot device.
Correct. Oh, everyone else is just a one-note plot device. And I think that's where it's failed for me. In all the other movies, there are three or four of them that are very interesting and have depth. And again, here everyone was one note. Like, I loved Virginia Madsen's performance. I thought she was incredible. But she was literally doing the same thing. From scene to scene to scene, it's the same game.
Yeah, there was just one thing which defined her mother, literally, in the whole
movie.
And
the same with Robert De Niro, and the same with her ex-husband, and the same with her friend. That's what was missing, I think.
You know, Robert De Niro and Silver Linings Playbook has a very small role. He has maybe four scenes, but it's so brilliant.
And it's meaningful.
And it's meaningful, and it really adds to the story. Here, it just seemed like he could have been a cardboard cutout. I mean, he gets angry when he's supposed to, and, you know, don't hire Isabella Rossellini and, you know, just have her stand around saying cute things in Italian. I mean, it's just, I don't know. I mean, and this is based on a true story. It is based on the woman who actually invented the miracle mop. Absolutely. I don't know how realistic it is other than that. So I don't understand why he felt this was a story that should be made into a movie. But again, Roger Ebert used to say it's not what the movie's about. It's how it is about what it is about. And I think the second half of the movie was not very compelling in terms of how it was about this woman's story. And in a way, you know, David O. Russell is trying to sell us snake oil, just like, you know, this character was trying to sell, you know, Miracle
really
Mop
point.
To the QVC audience. You know, she was trying to convince people to buy a product, and David O. Russell is trying to do the same thing to us, and I'm not buying it. Sorry. I mean, I just don't know. There was something very manufactured about it.
I agree with all of those points. And I think that's kind of why I introduced my opinion with a bit of annoyance around how deliberately he's playing the awards game. Mm-hmm. Because this is not an exceptional movie. It will get recognition. But had we seen this in, you know, May of this year, it wouldn't even be something we were talking about.
Correct.
In terms of awards. So, I agree with you both in that it's not a remarkable movie. And, you know, maybe you're punishing it in some ways because it's coming at a time when we are seeing many, many remarkable movies. But I think if I'd seen this, you know, as a kind of an early summer release, it would have come and gone. And I think, you know, we would have maybe had a lot lower in terms of expectations. But when you see David O. Russell on the poster,
and Jennifer Lawrence and Bradley Cooper and Robert De Niro,
you have high expectations. And I think, you know, for me, I don't, because I'm not a big fan of his in the sense of I didn't connect with The Fighter in the way that you guys did.
Yeah, I think we.
I didn't connect with American Hustle. I really liked Silver Linings, but he is very hit or miss for me as well.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else to say on this one? Okay, let's wind it up. So, Yazdi, you go first.
So, I know both The Hateful Eight and Joy are released on Christmas Day, and I hate to be, you know, Scrooge, but, you know, there's something very plastic about this movie, and, you know, Jennifer Lawrence acts her heart out. She really does. And I kind of felt bad that they didn't really know how to end the story, or the story does not have, you know, a strong last act. So, it kind of almost, you know, puffles into an end. It just kind of... loses steam, and then it come, you know, a movie by David O. Russell comes along. So honestly, I don't know what they saw in this. It's watchable. 5 out of 10.
Ouch. Sorry.
Joe?
I really enjoyed it. This was a good time at the movies for me. I can't say it's remarkable in any way, shape or form, but I'm going to give it a 7, and it's a really good, solid 7 for me. I mean, you know, I would recommend this pretty much to anyone. You know, just don't go in there expecting an award season level movie. It's just a very competently made, well-written, superbly acted film.
Yeah. I wish it had ended 5 minutes earlier. I didn't need that last...
scene,
right?
But again, I think it's trying to wrap things up nicely with a bow.
Yeah, so this is fine, just fine. It's enjoyable in the moment, but it's too frothy, and just like froth, it disappears from your mind very, very quickly. Unfortunately, not so joyful. 6 out of 10.
All right, well, let's wrap it up for today. Mail at movierollers.com, twitter.com/movierollers, facebook.com/movierollers. We like your likes. Like us on Facebook. If you don't already like us, or if your friends aren't already connected with us, please do that. It helps us with our numbers and makes us feel good. So if for no other reasons, do that for us. Until our next podcast, it's Too Many Movies, Too Little Time. Hey, good night from me.
And me.
And me as well.